On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, I'm back from vacation, excited to talk some ball. We discuss which main characters for the rest of the regular season are top of mind. Who are the players we're thinking about a lot? We discuss the Mariners calling up Cade Anderson, the top pitching prospect in baseball. What makes him special? A Ketel Marte update and an absolutely loaded edition of the good, the bad, the ugly. Of course, it's Friday. It's Baseball Barbacast. Let's do it.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks they should just get rid of the foul poles altogether. I'm Jake Mintz. That's George Schusterman. And whether the ball is fair or foul, like, umpires should just be able to clock it.
Wow. Yeah. You know, now that we've given them the ABS challenge system, given them a little bit of help there, we've had replay for several years. But now it's like, all right, umps, your entire focus should just be just really figuring out fair and foul. And unfortunately for the Baltimore Orioles, that did not go their way earlier this week, which was the most interesting thing that happened while I was on vacation, but it was certainly on the list.
More like an unfair poll. Jordan, it is wonderful to have you back. We had three pinch hitters filling in while you were gone. We hope that you had a wonderful time away, a time to unplug and remove yourself from the topsy-turvy campaign being had by the Seattle Mariners. The American League wildcard race is just as messy as it was when you left us. And on today's show, we are going to spend some time thinking about the main characters for the remainder of the season. That is our opener. It is Friday, August 21st. The season is getting ever smaller. I am starting to think about my high holiday plans, and that's how you know that October is right around the corner. And as we turn towards this final home stretch, we wanted to take a look and think about the season through the lens of the most important figures. Who is going to determine, to dictate, to impact the remainder of this season? Now, we're not talking about the playoffs. We're not just going to like pick Shohei Ohtani. Shohei Ohtani will not be selected here. Maybe Mark Walter should be selected. Shohei Ohtani will not be selected here. We're thinking about the remainder of the season. We're each going to take five players and go back and forth. Jordan, before I kick you the rock, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Ohtani is eligible. And I think the postseason as context and what we're building towards is still very relevant to a lot of the conversations we are about to have. But I do think that we wanted to focus on individual players. You know, you had your conversation with Kevin on Monday about the wild card and through a team lens. But now that we are past, I think we can officially say the dog days are behind us. And as you mentioned, once September shows up, it's like, all right, it's go time here. It starts to every game starts to feel very exciting. The standings you're looking at every day. But they're individual players, some of whom are playing very well and some of whom are playing very poorly, that we are thinking a lot about right now as we are running out of games to watch, perhaps some of them, if they're not going to make the postseason, but for them to make an impression on us before how we think about them before we even get to October.
Think about it this way. Jordan's not taking a vacation in September.
Right. I definitely timed it well. A lot did happen while I was gone, and it was an interesting exercise to unplug to that degree, which I've never done during the regular season, just straight up not watch anything and delete MLB app and delete Twitter for 4 days. It was great. But it also rejuvenated me, because when I logged back on yesterday morning, I was like, oh my goodness, no, I don't have any clarity in the AL wild card race. But there are some players who had some very interesting weeks. And so I'm just going to go ahead and take the first overall pick, Jake Mintz. And I'm going to take with my pick in terms of players that I'm thinking about. And I'm going to select Fernando Tatis Jr. of the San Diego Padres, who looks like he had a heck of a time while I was in Maine. And by the way, I should mention this in particular, because not that I'm one to have FOMO, and I'm certainly glad where I was. However, Fernando Tatis Jr. was in Cleveland last weekend, hitting some homers, playing some good baseball. I did miss the San Diego Padres in town. They took that series from the Guardians. And if there was something I felt like I was missing out on, it was seeing Tatis ball out. And this is someone who, remember, he didn't homer for the first 2 months I guess May 30th was his first homer. He was hitting the ball hard. He was still running the bases and playing great defense, but the ball, he was not elevating the ball. And now it's all started to come together. He had a two-homer game against the Mets earlier this week, and he robbed a homer, and he's tweeting again. When Tatis is feeling himself, first of all, the Padres are just like a completely different situation because they just suddenly become, we've talked about how Jackson Merrill has been really important to him, and maybe he'll get picked in the draft too. But really, Tatis, he does define this era of Padres baseball, for better or for worse, for all the other big names that have come through. Of course, Machado's a big part of that too, and Juan Soto's brief little stint there. But Tatis he's the guy. And when he's going, it kind of just feels like anything is possible.
So I don't want to read too much into this. He has tweeted twice since November 6th, 2023. Like twice at all. One was earlier this year in the WBC when he was doing the bit about Ohtani's green tea. Remember, he would like go to the podium and he would drink it and he would hold it and he would smile.
Yes.
And then the other was on, what day was this? On Tuesday, after he robbed the home run and homered twice, he tweeted the "Are you not entertained?" gif. The idea that Fernando Tatis Jr. is feeling himself enough to do this, I think, is bizarrely a relevant data point. Nobody like embodies this like unapologetic confidence. It is almost like sensual and like sexual, the way that Tatis plays baseball when he's at his best. Like, he's swaggering, he's kind of free and flowing and having the time of his life. And there have been moments over the last couple of years, like after he got popped for steroids and fell off a motorcycle and what, like, where he couldn't be his truest self in a way because of all of the wrong that he had done, where he kind of had to tone it down a little bit for the sake of the conversation. And we're starting to see that kind of fray away and him perform at his best on the field accordingly.
Yeah. And I will say, you mentioned his bit with Ohtani and trying to get the Japanese green tea sponsorship or whatever. I think the WBC was also an important part of this, right? I mean, he had never played for Team DR in the WBC because of his previous issues. He was a big part of that team in March. And then now that sort of then faded when the Padres are kind of, they're playing well, but he isn't hitting any home runs. And we're just like waiting for that. And so then he kind of was back in sort of the background. But now, and let's just talk about why I'm picking him here. Not only is he just one of the most fun players to watch, he is incredibly important to this Padres team as they push forward to trying to get this last playoff spot and get to a point where they can scare someone in October. Now, the starting pitching is probably going to define their ultimate ceiling, for better or for worse. We know the bullpen is special, but Tatis does just change the complexion of this team. And at the very least, it just makes me excited to tune in and watch the Padres. So I will happily take Tatis as my first pick, and I will send it back to you.
I'm going to take Philadelphia Phillies designated hitter Kyle Schwarber. Kyle Schwarber has been just fine for about 2 months now. He has a 755 OPS since July 1st with just 7 home runs to his name, 2 of which were struck at the Field of Dreams game last week. The Phillies have operated in this very bizarre place, kind of oscillating between legitimacy and fraudness. And here they are on a W6 in the second wildcard spot. 3 games safe, 4 games back of the Cubs for that top spot, 4.5, maybe 5 now of Atlanta. They won yesterday. And Schwarber has been the straw that stirs the drink. Hell yeah, dude. The straw that stirs the drink for the Phillies so often over the last couple of years. And for them to experience a dip and a rise all the while he has not played particularly well is very interesting. Can they make the playoffs without him at his best? Probably. Would it help? Oh, yeah. And for what he's come to mean for this team, for this operation, for the city, for him to hit a bit of a cold stretch here, I think is pretty interesting.
Yeah. Schwarber, we know when it's bad, it's pretty bad. But when it's good, you know, stay out of the way because he's probably going to hit a home run. And I agree. I think that we're still getting used to like the complexion of this Luis Arraez. I almost wanted to pick Luis Arraez, honestly, for this draft, and you know, maybe he'll come up. But the Phillies offense and how it's impacting Schwarber and how it's impacting Bryce and how the defense is coming together is all very interesting. So I think the Phillies, because they were playing much better recently, even without Schwarber contributing that much besides in Iowa, I feel good about where they're at. Is there still an opportunity to chase down the Atlanta Braves with how they've been slipping? Probably not, but I don't know. I was actually wondering, do they play again this season? They do have. Oh, they play 7 more times. Okay. All right. Okay. You know what? I'll use that as my transition I was going to pick a Brave. So, but anything else on Schwarber?
Yeah. Well, just on the Phillies in general, like I've mentioned this multiple times. The complexion of this offense before and after the arrival of Luis Arraez is so funny. From opening day until they acquire Arraez, the Phillies as a team were running an 8% walk rate. That was 27th in the sport. Okay. Since getting Arraez on August 3rd, they are now running a league best walk rate. They are leading baseball with a 12.5% walk rate in the Luis Arraez era. So they have gone from 27 to 1 in the span of a couple of weeks. Is that sustainable? Probably not to that extent, but that is a definitive shift. Like the way that this offense is moving is different with this guy in it.
It's just so funny to be like, wow, their walk rate went up in the Luis Arraez era. It ain't because Luis Arraez is walking.
He doesn't walk.
That's the thing. It's when everybody else, they're like, well, wait a minute. We'd rather just pitch to this guy because what's the worst he can do? Dump it over the second baseman's head? And the answer is kind of yes. I know he had a couple homers or two homers with the Phillies.
Two homers. He's two as a Philly.
They are weird, but okay. We're not picking Arraez. Okay. Well, let's use this as a transition back to the National League East. Because a lot of the things that we just said about Fernando Tatis Jr., minus the motorcycle accident, thankfully, and the PED suspension, you could say about Ronald Acuña Jr. of the Atlanta Braves. However, Ronald Acuña Jr. has not rediscovered his swagger in a way that makes me feel like the Braves are going to win the World Series. He, of course, has dealt with multiple hamstring injuries this season that have limited him in a way that, you know, you look at some of the underlying data, you see he's still hitting the ball hard and you see these glimpses. He's clearly not much of a factor in the outfield anymore. I mean, he's still got the arm, but the overall production, you know, the range is certainly not there. And I'm kind of picking him as just like for the same reason as Tatis and just wondering if that is going to happen at some point here, because the Braves have made it quite far with him playing 76 games with a 110 OPS plus. You know, I think how he looks going into October is how we're going to feel about their ceiling. Another team that, of course, the starting pitching is probably going to matter more than what happens with the offense. But this has been the year of Matt Olson. This has been the year of Drake Baldwin. Austin Riley continues to struggle to a degree. Austin Riley, yeah, him figuring it out would be important, but I'm not really counting on that in any sort of at this point. Like, he's just having a bad season and has been trending in the wrong direction for a while. Acuña, I mean, last year was still really awesome. I mean, when he played, he had a 161 OPS plus. It has not looked like that this year to any degree. And so he's 28. I don't think he's suddenly declining, but this is also someone that has just dealt with so many lower body injuries that you just have to wonder if he's struggling to find that consistent explosiveness in every sense. And so I just wonder, and I hope that we see it, because if the Braves are really going to make a push here to beat the Dodgers, to beat the Brewers, to hold on, to win the division, to win the top seed, he's going to have to get going here at some point, and it just hasn't happened. I still think it can, though. I am not counting this guy out at all, but it, sure. it's it's been a lot of stop and start this year, and he's just been so irrelevant. I guess maybe that's the reason why I'm taking him. It just feels like the Met cannot last for much longer.
So one of the most bizarre dynamics of the last decade of our sport, half decade, no player has like defined this Braves era of baseball more than Ronald Acuña Jr. He is the face of this era, right? That is a fact. Here's another fact. Ronald Acuña Jr. has won two playoff series on the field as a member of the Atlanta Braves.
Right.
Those two playoff series came in 2020. One was that outrageous, low-scoring, three-game wild card round style thing against the Reds. Remember when like no one could score?
Yeah.
And then the other one was the following round when they kicked the snot out of the Marlins before they lost to the Dodgers in the NLCS and what was a great series. He was not healthy and on the field in 2021 when they won that series, right? He was not a factor. And so you have this one thing where it's like the Braves have been such a success story on the whole, and Ronald has been a big part of that, and yet he has not experienced postseason success. Him getting himself right between now and October is going to be a huge part of how he performs in October.
Because it's like, oh, Ronald in October, remember the grand slam he hit against Walker Buehler? That was 2018. That was so long ago. Oh, my goodness. He was a child. We were all children. And notably, you mentioned, of course, not being healthy in 21. They lost in 22 and 23. And he played in those series, but he didn't hit any home runs. And he didn't really do that much. So, Acuña, easy pick for me. Let's go back to you.
PCA. Peter Armstrong, how he performs over the last 5 weeks is not really going to dictate the playoff picture too much. Like, the Cubs have sort of floated in their own territory in the National League, where they're probably not catching the Brewers and they're probably not getting caught by the Phillies. So, like, we feel pretty good about them having home field advantage in a wild card series. And yet, like, that's kind of where they are. Could they catch the Brewers? Could the Phillies catch them? Yeah, certainly. That hasn't felt particularly relevant for a while now. But yet, can PCA pull this thing off is one of the biggest storylines of the last 5 weeks. Can this guy actually beat Shohei Ohtani to win the MVP? The answer right now of can he is absolutely. When we talked about it about a month and a half ago when Ohtani stopped pitching, the conversation was, yeah, let's see how he does. Can he keep this up? And he has kept it up. And then some. He's now at 31 steals, 31 homers. I think if he gets to 40-40, it's his. That feels a little bit ambitious at this point. Could he hit 9 home runs over the rest of the season? Absolutely. He certainly could. PCA, with what he's done defensively, with what he's meant to this Cubs team, hitting that walk-off home run this week against the White Sox kind of felt like a moment that we were sort of, not like that we didn't needed it, but that it really does help in terms of thinking about him as an MVP candidate. I think he's the favorite, but because of how streaky of a hitter he's been throughout his career, just as much as you can envision him going to 40-40, there's a path where you could envision him kind of getting cold. And so what PCA does between now and the end of the year is it's so freaking interesting to me.
Yeah. And I would say that, as we've talked about him, the improvements that he's made with his approach in theory protects against a cold streak like that, but he is still whiffing a lot. He is still chasing a good amount. So I think that there's room. And the other part of this is there's another guy that's still playing baseball every day, and he's going to hit some home runs too. And so, and maybe pitch at some point. That part doesn't seem that likely, but it's still on the table. And I do think that, like, even if Ohtani came back and made two awesome starts, people would be like, wait a minute, that's obviously
look at that.
But we'll see. I totally agree. I think that I know when we first had this conversation a few weeks ago, I was like still leaning Ohtani. No, PCA can win it. He probably is the favorite right now. There are a lot of awards related picks that I think we could go in that direction with this conversation. I don't think I'll be doing any of those, but this is a good
interesting
one.
Yeah. Award conversation by a mile for a number of reasons. And I think it's more about PCA than it is about Ohtani. I think, like, If Ohtani comes back and makes five starts, like, it changes the dynamic. But that's not happening. Like, I am very skeptical that Ohtani is coming back during the season to make five legitimate full six-inning starts. Like, he'll probably pitch again in the regular season, but it's not going to be in a way that moves the needle in this conversation at all.
Probably not. Right. I mean, there is a whole Ohtani thing, right? It's like, especially if the Dodgers don't have a bye and have to pitch, would that be his first pitching appearance? That's hard for me to believe if he is planning on pitching again this year. It's hard for me to imagine that, like, game three of the wild card series would be the first time he would pitch in however many months. But anyway, we're not picking Ohtani. Let's move him to the side. All right, PCA, very good pick for you. I am going to go with a little bit of a homer pick and take Jose Ramirez of the Cleveland Guardians.
That was my pick.
And I think that you and Kevin talked about the AL wildcard race and you kind of both defaulting to the Cleveland Guardians because of how ridiculously easy their schedule is for the rest of the season. It is something that I have also come back to over and over as I try and figure out this Guardians team, seeing them in person. I'm in kind of a weird stretch right now where I'm going like a month between seeing them because they were home while I was on vacation and then they were on the road and now they're on the road again. And then I'm going to be in Detroit to watch the Dodgers. So I haven't really seen the Guardians that much recently. And Jose Ramirez, of course, has been injured. He came back about a month ago now, but he still just hasn't quite looked the same. And yeah, we just don't really know what it looks like when the Guardians are winning and he's not the main guy. I think because of his injury, because it was a hamate, you gotta be patient with that. But this is still an offense that is in the bottom three in team OPS. And while it has been nice to have rookies like Chase DeLauder, who's been really, you know, consistent, and Stephen Kwan, who's been unbelievable for the last month and a half or so, and Bezzano, who certainly cooled off. He's kind of hit some level of rookie wall, but also someone who's still talented and someone that you're excited to see how he can finish. I mean, let's not overcomplicate it. Yes, pitching is going to define Cleveland as it always does, but this team really doesn't have much of a chance if Jose Ramirez can't get it going. Now, what does that really mean? Can they beat a bunch of these bad teams over the next month and a half without him being an MVP level player? Yes, probably. But this still feels like, remember, he just signed this third extension this past winter. That was the Jose's here forever. And part of that, why it was like, well, yeah, sure, why not? Not just because of all the obvious reasons that Jose Ramirez is important in Cleveland. He was as good as ever last year. I mean, this was not someone that looked to be in any sort of decline, even as he enters his mid-30s. And so for him to have this season, for whatever the reasons are, whether it is injury related, whether it is just this kind of weird year, it's been disappointing. I won't say it's been concerning, but it's been disappointing. However, there is still time for him to be like, hey guys, remember, I'm a first ballot Hall of Famer. So let's I'm still the guy here. Especially, I'm still the thing that makes this whole thing go. And I hope that he can, especially if he is facing all these bad teams, let's see if he can get it going.
Yep. That's the thing. The story is setting up here in a really nice way for Jose Ramirez, where it's like, he's been okay. Yep. The team has stayed in it. He hasn't been himself. Oh, you get to face, you know, all these below average teams for the next month and a half and you can catch fire. And Jose Ramirez against bad teams feels like a great, like, particularly, you know what I mean? Like, he's going to steal a lot of bags. Like, he's going to run wild. He's going to take extra bases. Like, he's going to do the little things that these other teams don't do well. I'm going to stay in that division.
Oh, okay. Yeah, go ahead.
And I'm going to take Kenley Jansen. Kenley Jansen. Wow.
Okay. All right. Yes.
Kenley Jansen is a fascinating character right now. He is the, for those of you who don't know, Kenley Jansen is the closer of the Detroit Tigers. Okay. Kenley Jansen, who 85 years ago was a legendary Los Angeles Dodger. It's been a minute now, man. He has not been in the Dodgers since 2021. Went Braves, Red Sox, Angels, and now the Detroit Tigers. He's been this team's capital C closer all season long. He has saved 16 games. He has been fine. He's been fine. Not embarrassing, not great, but just fine. He blew one the other night, the other afternoon, excuse me, against the Pittsburgh Pirates. And this team, the Detroit Tigers, after trading Skubal, have generally been good. Their offense has been good. The rotation has been outstanding without Skubal, in large part thanks to guys like Troy Melton. The weak point of this operation is the bullpen. And the idea that it all rests upon Kenley Jansen, of all people, to keep the Tigers in the hunt is ridiculous. Like, how did we end up here? You know, with like Skubal goes to the Dodgers and is, you know, Kenley stays behind. We're going to have Skubal and the Dodgers coming to Detroit in a couple of weeks. And it'll be like, hey, Kenley, remember all the Dodgers? I'm just like, I can see a scenario where he does not hold some games down that end up coming back to bite the Tigers. Just that they have entrusted this guy with this role on this team this season is perplexing.
Yes. And he's not the only problem in this bullpen. Kyle Finnegan has had some tough ones. I know this is the first time he blew a save in a while. He has had some real clunkers. Yes. Our friend Foolish Baseball just had a very, really, really good video on his now main channel, Foolish Bailey, about the Tigers' bullpen usage. It was really, really interesting stuff there. But I, in terms of Kenley, like, I will always, and this will be true until they're all done, you know, lump him with Chapman and Craig Kimbrell. And those three closers who have really defined that position for the last 10 years have taken very different paths. And particularly over the last few years, it's gone in a very interesting way where Chapman is still one of the best relievers in the world, clearly. Kimbrell has become this just bizarre journeyman where he just refuses to retire and is just bouncing between all these teams.
He's a meme. And
yeah, he's it's like sad. this weird thing that's like he's still hanging on and he's still a big leaguer, but he's not. He's so far removed from like a guy that feels anything like a Hall of Famer. Whereas Kenley Jansen has held on to these closer jobs, but he's also still clearly so much worse than he used to be. So he's like weird in between, and he's the one, you know, chasing. Right, isn't he going for 500 saves? Oh my goodness. And that's another thing that he's chasing is 500 saves. And you can't blow ones like you did against the Pirates if you're going to get the 500 this year, my guy. And I don't know if he said, it seems like he could still pitch again another season. I don't know where that's been. He had that weird with the Braves and then the Red Sox and then the Angels last year and now the Tigers. So he's like he's in between the Chapman and Kimbrell in an interesting sense. But to your point, with the Tigers in particular and how their season is going. Yeah.
When he joined the Angels, it felt like it was like, okay, Kenley Jansen is trying to get to 500 saves. He's going to do that on teams that don't really matter. We're never going to have to think about him pitching in big moments anymore. And now he's the closer for the Tigers.
Yes. Well said. Right, it's like uh-oh, and might be part of their undoing, or at least
became
was in that one
network
game.
Work again.
You listen, dude. You just said, "Oh, Mike, that could be the difference." That game right there, where you allowed back-to-back homers, they missed the postseason by one game. Of course, you could say, "Well, hey, what if they had Tarik Skubal?" Yeah, duh. But that will be part of it too, because of how frustrating that bullpen has been. All right, let's pick a couple more quickly. I'm going to go with another American League pitcher, and that's Freddy Peralta of the Tampa Bay Rays. He's someone that I kind of already made this pick after he was traded to Tampa Bay, but I just think because of where the Rays are at and their very likely chances of being the top seed in the American League, the pressure that that's going to come with once they get there. But then also just individually, right? Freddy Peralta, how much money has he lost this year with free agency approaching? How much money could he gain back over the next 6 weeks and then maybe October with whatever fixes he does with Tampa Bay? It sounds like he's already, you know, added to throw more changeups. He's done some delivery work to get some of the extension back that made him great with Milwaukee. Is there enough time to make those fixes? And then, especially because, like, for the Rays, they're in good position in the standings. So they can kind of, not that he's going out there throwing experimental bullpen sessions, but he kind of has the wiggle room to figure stuff out with his new team, with Kyle Snyder, with his catcher, his new catchers, his new environment, new team, before they get to October. And then it's like every start could swing his free agent contract tens of millions of dollars, right? And maybe that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but I do think that now that he is on this team that is important, now that he is going to be counted on to start a postseason game for them, even before we get there, how many tweaks we see with him and if he can really get back on track. Because it's been mixed so far, right? The numbers don't look great so far with Tampa Bay, but you still see these flashes, and if anyone's going to get out of him, it's going to be them. So I'm very, very interested in Freddie Peralta.
I'll stay in the American League. I'm going to go with Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who has still not hit a home run at home this season.
Oh.
You
and is now and hurt. Me. Now is on the IL.
And is so he is now hurt. He's on the IL. He played in a rehab game yesterday for Dunedin in low A against Clearwater. Very spring training coded. Ripped a double in his first plate appearance off of Yordanis Guerra, who, can you imagine, like, you're this kid in low A with the Phillies, and you're from San Pedro de Macorís in the Dominican Republic, and you're starting in low A, and you have to face Vlad. That social dynamic is something that is fascinating to me, and I think about all the time. He looked like Vlad. He's coming back from a concussion issue, which are always a little bit scary. The idea that he's already played in a rehab game says that he'll probably be back soonish. The Toronto Blue Jays somehow are a half game out, despite all of this, despite trading guys away at the deadline, despite Vlad being just forgettable. He has a chance to make himself a hero again. No one is like furious at Vlad. He has been so disappointing, but because of what he accomplished last season, he has a lot of leash to play with. But if he comes back and throws this team on his back over the last 5 weeks, 4 weeks of the year, I mean, we're going to then remember this season as Vlad carrying the Jays to the playoffs.
I guess. I mean, he's going to have to because, boy, is this offense bad. That was one of the funniest back and forths that you and Kevin had on Monday, was Kevin being like, man, this defense is elite. And you were like, this offense sucks.
You can't win nil-nil.
I was like, yes, so true. I'm so glad I missed that he played this rehab game. That's important because Vlad has not played a minor league game since he's been in the big leagues.
Wow.
And there's a couple guys like that. Like Otani has famously never played a minor league game. That's not surprising. But there's
will.
A couple other guys like that who are usually like they're too good or too. Honestly, Jose Ramirez, I'm not sure the last time he played a minor league rehab game, but guys where it's like, I'm hurt, but you're not sending me to Akron. Sorry. You know,
Judge has not played.
Okay.
Judge has not played a minor league game since 2019 and has had a bevy of injuries since then. Like there are guys who just don't want to get on that bus.
Yeah. And by the way, Judge is one I was thinking about in this regard, right? Is he going to go play in Scranton when he's coming back? That is a very good one. I like that. Okay. And a good transition to my final pick here, Roman Anthony, who also participated in a rehab game earlier this week in which he hit a home run for the AA Portland Sea Dogs. Oh, baby. Here comes Roman Anthony, last seen in the Boston Red Sox lineup on May 4th. That's a long time ago. Meanwhile, the Red Sox have had one of the stranger regular seasons we've ever seen from any baseball team. They've now settled into a much more normal part of their season where they've stopped going up and down in a crazy way and they're just playing like a regular, decent baseball team. However, Roman Anthony coming back would be just so fascinating. I think now they've like done enough to where it doesn't feel like it's going to be all on him, but I am still going to kind of judge this team's offensive ceiling by how Roman Anthony looks whenever he comes back in the next little bit. It's a lot to ask. He's what, 21, 22. We just turned 22. But this was everything he showed last year. Seemed like it was ready to be one of the best hitters in the American League. So that's probably a lot to ask of this guy coming off this injury, this hand injury that has haunted him for a really long time now. That's a long time off. So we'll see. But I'm really, really, really excited to just see what this looks like. I'm excited to not watch Jaron Duran hit anymore. Also, you know?
Yeah.
I imagine Red Sox fans are excited about that too. So that's just what this looks like. I'm just so curious because that is also going to be a big part of how we think about the Red Sox come October.
A lot of other names on the board. I'll speed run. Kyle Tucker, Edwin Diaz. That's more for October, but like, can they get right over the last couple of weeks? Ketel Marte, who we'll talk about in a second. Paul Skeens, who was bad again on Wednesday. What in the world? Garrett Crochet fills a similar category to Roman Anthony. Aaron Judge, Yordan Alvarez, Luis Castillo for the White Sox, Byron Buxton,
really good one.
Pete Alonso, Jacob DeGrom, but I just have to take Cal Raleigh here. The right Mariners pick, honestly, is probably Pobo, Jerry DePoto, or manager Dan Wilson of can they turn the Evergreen around and while it's stuck in the Suez Canal. But Cal Raleigh, who defined the 2025 Mariners season, is now defining the 2026 Mariners season in the other way. He was the emblem. He is still the emblem.
Great point.
But now that he's not producing, it's for bad reasons. If the Mariners don't make the playoffs, Jordan, we will remember this season as Cal Raleigh, his failure. And now that's not fair. There are a lot of other reasons this team won't have made the playoffs. But I think it starts and stops with him. And so, like Vlad, he has an opportunity in front of him. Like, if Cal gets hot, goes on a heater, and he can carry this team to the playoffs, much will be forgotten and forgiven. Will that happen? I remain skeptical. I am so excited for the last couple of weeks. Jordan, you and I talk about, it's a very morbid conversation, but like the worst time to die during a big league season so that you don't know what happened. And right now we have these they're mysteries, right? They're these large questions about the sport and the characters in them that are, we're like, so it's the perfect amount. Like, how is this going to go? How's this going to play out? Hero or villain? Will they succeed or will they fail? So like right now, like late August is a bad time to go.
Yeah. Well said.
So hang on, everyone. If you're listening to this, if you're listening to this podcast, don't die on us.
Yeah. Thank you for, that was fun. That was a fun game. Let us know. Who are you thinking about? Email us, baseballwarbycast@gmail.com. We're going to take a break. When we return, more Mariners news, and it's good news. Oh my goodness. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's go around the league. The Seattle Mariners, a team mired in woe, have called up their top prospect. Not just their top prospect, but the top pitching prospect in the world. Cade Anderson, the number 3 overall pick in the 2025 draft. LSU World Series winner will make his debut Saturday at home against the Chicago Cubs. This is a team in need of a spark. There have been some on the internet machine clamoring for Anderson to be called up for a while now, including, for some reason, Bill Simmons. You can maybe explain that. Why a guy that doesn't really follow baseball besides his AL-only keeper league.
Jake, you just heard... Nailed it. Everyone just heard Jake figuring that out as he... Yes, that is exactly what it is. My understanding is that Bill Simmons has an AL keeper league going back to like the 90s, and I think he has Cade Anderson and has been wondering why the guy who has, I mean, it's one of the most dominant minor league pitching seasons we've really ever seen. If you have not been following what Mr. Anderson has been doing for the Arkansas Travelers this season, it is, I mean, I can't really remember... Maybe Dylan Bundy, like, because normally, guys, especially nowadays, like, these guys just don't get to make this many starts in the minors. They usually get called up, and you do have to wonder how many other teams, and of course, competitive window where they are, how many other teams would he have been up for 2 months ago. Half the league. I mean, probably more than half the league. I don't really know. Of course, the Mariners rotation has been an interesting subplot of their season. But okay, let's move Bill Simmons to the side. Let's move the Mariners rotation depth chart to the side, and let's just talk about Cade Anderson. The fact that he's even on the Mariners is already like a shocking, like the fact that the Mariners were able to draft him, let's rewind to that point, is an amazing sequence of events, which is one of the great strokes of lottery luck in the short history of the MLB draft lottery. The Seattle Mariners in 2024
went 85-77.
They won 85 games, but because they weren't in the postseason, they had like a 0.6% chance of jumping into the top whatever. They jump all the way up to the number three pick. But the luck doesn't stop there, because then you get to draft day and you're looking at the top of the board and you're seeing Eli Willits and Ethan Holliday and Cade Anderson. And Cade Anderson was pretty much considered, there was no doubt that he was like the top pitcher. And the two teams picking ahead of the Mariners in 2025 were the Nationals and the Angels. And once we got to draft day, it was like, okay, it seems like the Nationals, they could take Cade Anderson, but it really does seem like they're considering one of the hitters. They obviously go with Eli Willits, the young shortstop.
And that has worked out.
And then, yeah. And then the Angels, you would think, okay, well, what do the Angels do? They take the guy that's closest to the big leagues, right? This is still Perry and whatever. So surely if they're going to follow that, who better to draft than Cade Anderson? I mean, you could put this guy in your rotation tomorrow and he's probably not going to embarrass himself. And for reasons that are still kind of unclear, the Angels selected Tyler Bremner, right-hander from UCSB, who I should say is also a very good pitching prospect. And I can also tell you the Mariners really like Tyler Bremner as well. However, when Tyler Bremner goes at two and the Mariners are like, wait, what? Cade Anderson, the best player in the draft, is here at three? And we're the Mariners and we already have all these pitchers and we're great with pitchers. This is like the luckiest thing of all time. And we won 85 games last year. They take Cade Anderson out of LSU. And I mean, since then, he's been ridiculous. Obviously, he makes his pro debut this year. This is someone who at LSU was kind of bounced. He had Tommy John in high school, so he was a redshirt guy. And his freshman year in 24, he was pretty good. But then last year, he was unbelievable. He caps off his college career with a 130-pitch complete game shutout in the College World Series finals against Coastal Carolina as they win it all. And his numbers in college were ridiculous. And then his numbers this year, just for those of you who have not seen, 18 starts in Double A, 1.06 ERA, 93 innings, 135 strikeouts, a 0.643 WHIP. He only allowed 47 hits across those 93 innings. I think what makes Cade Anderson so interesting is that the modern pitching prospect nowadays is like big guy throws the nastiest stuff you've ever seen. He's overwhelming you with velocity. And the Mariners do have another Mizorowski, right? I mean, he's his own category, but yes, that's the prototype that you're used to. And the Mariners have another one of those guys. That's Ryan Sloan. Maybe we'll see him next year. But Cade Anderson is not that. His fastball averages 93-94, and he can ramp it up there to 95, 96 here and there. His command of four pitches and just is as good as I've really ever seen of any pitching prospect, certainly in college. I mean, you just do not see with this amount of precision and depth of arsenal at the college level, even in this era of pitch design and all these pitchers adding, he was just so dialed in. And the fact that he's somehow taken another leap in that regard in pro ball so far is why he has made Double A hitters look completely hopeless.
But what's so interesting to me about Cade Anderson is that the conversation coming out of college was he's getting outs with average velocity. Mm-hmm. How are the Mariners going to make him better? Oh, it'll probably be by adding a couple of ticks of velocity. That's not really what's happened here, right? It's been
not really
him getting like he's not throwing softer, but it's him getting better at the things that already made him good.
Yep.
Instead of this leap in throwing harder. As I watch, you know, highlights of him, like what type of pitcher is this? This is like a kind of a weird comp and maybe lazy. It's like Kershaw before he got old, but after he was throwing gas, right? Like 2018 to 2022 Kirsch, where it's like multiple pitches, elite command, great sequencing, knows how to throw. But it's not, he's like, Cade Anderson is dominating without blowing people's doors off, which in this era of baseball is going to be a very unique watch to see, can he run these strikeout rates without throwing 96, 97 miles an hour?
Yeah, and we shouldn't totally discount the velo. Like, he is throwing, he's holding velo. He has been holding it deeper into starts, and he'll take it up. But if you think of other current comps, it's like, right, what lefty pitchers right now are doing this without like a truly ridiculous elite pitch like a Chris Sale slider, or you're throwing really hard and you have like a sinker like a Christopher Sanchez? You know, Parker Messick is an interesting version of this.
Sure.
He relies on a little bit more deception, but it's the same kind of thing with sequencing, and he's not throwing quite as hard. But I do think that just from a command standpoint, not walking guys, limiting hard contact, it's the complete package, and why I think he is, why they're going to feel like he's ready for this. Where he fits in the Mariners rotation is interesting. Is this too little too late to give it the Mariners any sort of spark? Probably, but who knows? As we know, you're not dead in the AL until the season's basically over. So are they moving Emerson Hancock to the bullpen? Are they moving Bryce Miller to the bullpen? I don't know. The other interesting thing is the Mariners haven't had a lefty starting pitcher at all since Marco Gonzalez, like 3 years ago. It's been all righties. Wow. But I just think, and I'm going to write about Cade today, they've had all these guys. Their entire rotation is homegrown. They're, I think, the only team in baseball that can say that. But Cade Anderson is the most hyped of all of them, right? I mean, this is the guy that coming out compared to those all those other guys. And yes, those were other first-round picks for sure. But that's, you know, Logan Gilbert and George Kirby coming out of mid-majors. That's Emerson Hancock in the weird shortened 2020 season. Bryce Miller and Brian Wu were not elite prospects whatsoever. Cade Anderson is arriving with the expectation that he is going to be great immediately. And so what that looks like, how he handles that, I'm excited and confident. And frankly, just a reason for me to want to watch the Mariners, which, as we've talked about at length, there have been more reasons to not watch them lately. And I am very excited for Saturday, where he will be thrown to the Wolves against one of the best offenses in baseball, the Cubs, who are the best offense in baseball against left-handed pitching. So have at it. You know, at least he'll get to pitch at home. It's not a Wrigley, but I'm very excited to see how he does there.
Jordan, a cursory look tells me that there are two other rotations in baseball completely made up of homegrown starters. Give yourself a little think. I'm just going off of roster resource right now. The Washington Nationals is one of
those
two.
Which has not been true all season, but
it has not been true all season.
It is now by default, sure. Okay.
Yes. And there is one other team that's actually an easier answer than the Nats. The Nats are employing Cade Cavalli, Andrew Alvarez, Brad Lord, Jake Irvin, and Jackson Kent as their five-man rotation now that they have jettisoned Miles Michaelis and Foster Griffin and Zach Littell. So they do have five homegrown guys. The other team, as you struggle to think about it, is the Pittsburgh Pirates with Skeens, Chandler Jones, Machinsky, and Braxton Ashcraft. Let's move from a guy that is excited to play Major League Baseball to one that won't be doing that for some reason. Ketel Marte. Last Jordan was on the podcast, Ketel Marte was just a regular big leaguer. A good one, having a disappointing season, but a guy that showed up to work. Since Jordan went on vacation, Ketel Marte has become something different. He's become one of the more confounding storylines in the entire sport. We have an pretty meaningful update since we last recorded on Wednesday. That is Ketel Marte, who did not show up to work on Monday and then provided very little information to the Arizona Diamondbacks front office, coaching staff, GM Mike Hazen. They just did not know what was going on. Marte and club officials met on Thursday per Nick Pecoro. He is being moved off the restricted list to the 10-day injured list with left knee inflammation. Pecoro described Hazen describing the meeting as, quote, productive. It included Marte, his agent, Charisse Espinoza-Dash, which is just a great name. Tori Lovello, Hazen himself, probably some other people in that room. Quote from Hazen, we discussed the last week, but obviously I'm not going to get into it. He'll talk to his teammates at some point and we'll go from there. Hazen said that Marte could be back by the end of the 10-day IL stint. What in the world is going on here? The most important thing that has occurred, this meeting, making it happen, is now the Diamondbacks seem to know what's going on. My understanding is before yesterday that the Diamondbacks were pretty much as in the dark as the rest of us. Based upon the way Hazen's talking about it, they now seem to have more information than the public does. Whether that is all the information, whether that is enough information to like feel comfortable and satisfied with how things have played out is a completely different story. I would say that at some point we'll all figure out what went on here. It doesn't seem like that's going to happen anytime soon. Jordan, you have not had the opportunity to speak on where in the world is Carmen Sandiego Ketel Marte. So I'll give you the floor to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that him even suggesting that he could be back is, I guess, encouraging, but I don't feel like I know much more. He has a knee injury. Let's follow that path of logic or information, right? Does that explain not showing up? There's a lot of guys that are dealing with things, right? That he could have shown up and say, my knee hurts and I don't want to play. That happens all the time.
Maybe couldn't walk to the bus.
Right.
Because of the knee.
So, oh, okay. That's why he's like, sorry, I'm stuck in bed because my knee hurts so much. Maybe that sounds a lot more serious than it probably is. So, yeah, I think you guys covered it well when you talked about earlier this week. Just like, it's hard for me to really... It's easy for anyone, if you're a Diamondbacks fan or not, to just be like, wow, what a crappy teammate. It's hard for us to really gauge how this is being taken in the room. And it does put, and you also mentioned this on Wednesday, like because of where they're at in their own job security and the pressure on the Diamondbacks to get back to the postseason this year and how important Ketel Marte is, that does put Mike Hazen and Tori Lovello in a really tough spot.
Yeah.
Because Marte is the one that is more secure. Because he signed an extension, he has 10-5 rights. Like, he's not really going anywhere if it's up to him. He's obviously also one of their best players. I just wonder to what degree. And this is also one that's going to be hard to know for the players. What are the players going to say publicly? Because so far they've all been very public in their support, and I would expect that to continue. I don't know if he comes. If anything, if he comes back in the next 10 days, it's just even weirder. You know, like, yeah. It's good. I would like to see him back playing baseball for the Diamondbacks to have a chance here. But you don't want this to be more serious, but it also is so hard to understand just with kind of the sequence of events and how openly someone like Derek Hall, the president, has been like, we don't know what's going on. Right.
Yeah.
So that's where it becomes certainly hard for me to comment any further than that. But I guess the IL placement makes me feel slightly better than him just being on the restricted list with some mysterious situation.
There's a path back now. And the idea that Hazen and Lovello, who have sort of hitched their wagon to Ketel Marte, that is a volatile character to, you know, put all the chips on. And that is proven to be an issue time and time again. But, you know, when this guy's on the field, he's a dynamite performer.
Yep.
Like, he's a really good player. This sort of reminds me of, I don't know if you've ever watched The Sopranos, but something that happens in The Sopranos is like, a guy will go away. Like, one of the mobsters will just like go away for a stretch and then he'll come back and he'll like just try and be normal. And everyone's like, hey, were you on the lam because you were like informing or there's like a hit out on you? And then the guy's like, no, everything's fine. Like, it's cool. And then like everything is usually not fine in the end. I am fascinated to see what Marte does when he speaks to media for the first time, like when he comes back, because.
Sure.
And this is what's tough, right? And we can kind of finish with this. Marte is entitled to privacy and his own mental peace and his own emotional peace, and does not need to share the specifics of his entire life with the public. However, he does owe the fan base and his teammates something, because the way that this sport works, it's not like, I think I've mentioned this before, it's not like taxpayer money, but it's not like taxpayer money. The fans are, in a way, paying for Ketel Marte's house. Now, he has earned that by being really good at the sport and by working really hard and whatever, but you can't go away and not give people something. Because if you're asking, part of the dynamic of the sport is for the fans to become attached to these people as characters. That's why they spend the money. That's why the players get to have nice things. That has to be a two-way street to a certain extent. I'm not saying that everything needs to be public, but there needs to be a little bit more open communication here than what we've seen from Marte.
Yes.
And I know that, like, maybe there is a mental health component to this. I totally get that. I need a little more. I just need a little bit more, whether that's from him or the organization. I think sure. Fans in Arizona deserve a little bit more than what they've been getting.
Yep. I think that is fair. We're going to take a break. When we return, oh, I'm so excited. I'm back for this. It's the Good, the Bad, the Ugly. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbiecast. No way I was going to miss 2 weeks of this in a row. It's time for the Good, the Bad, the Ugly.
One thing good, one thing bad, one thing Dan Ugly. Bizarre, odd, out of the ordinary from the week in baseball. Jordan Schusterman, welcome back. Take it away.
Obviously, once I logged back on Thursday, my first goal was look at all the scores and whatever. And then I was like, wait, I got to figure out good, bad, ugly. And it took so little time because, my goodness, was there a lot to choose from this week in all three categories. But I will start yes. In Appleton, Wisconsin. Oh, baby. One of our favorite places. Home
that we've
of
never
the
been.
Milwaukee, that we've never been. Home of the Milwaukee Brewers. High A affiliate, Wisconsin Timber Rattlers. And the first professional home run of Sawyer Strohsnyder, outfielder, was just selected in the second round by the Milwaukee Brewers out of TCU. I had him ranked in the top 20. Oops. I wasn't the only one. He falls to pick 66. He's an outfielder with big pop, big swing and miss. And he had his first home run of his professional career. That is not that exciting because, of course, Sawyer Strohsnyder hit a home run. That's not news. But who did he hit the home run to? Directly to his father, who was standing out beyond the right field fence on the party deck and caught this baseball. The video of this, his dad was recording this, and essentially you see the ball come off the bat from the right center field wall. And then he just drops the phone and you hear him go catch the ball. And he just screams, "That's my son." Story on MLB.com about this from Sam Dykstra and Ben Weinrib is incredible. And the funniest part is this quote from his dad. Because he was like in this area beyond the right field fence, very minor league baseball, where you kind of have like these private situations going on. You can reserve it. Classic Midwest League action. His dad, Scott, says, quote, "The people on the party deck were like, you know, this is a private party. I was like, well, my son's about to hit a home run that I'm going to catch." Now, listen, maybe Scott Strohsnyder is making this up. Maybe. But even if he is, I mean, the audacity to make it up is also kind of awesome. But if he's telling the truth, I mean, this is one of the great, you know, shot calls / flexes in the history of the sport. I mean, this is the coolest thing ever. What a thing.
We talked.
So I love it.
From time to time about how our faith in a higher power is reaffirmed when things that are too serendipitous to not have something up there. And this, to me, is in that category. Like, this is nuts. My favorite part of this video is when Sawyer Strohsnyder rounds first base, like every hitter now, for some reason, they do the thing where they give like the love sign out to the bullpen.
Yeah.
But Sawyer Strohsnyder does not seem to see that his dad is the one that caught the ball. And he's like rounding second and like, look.
I interpreted it as like, I think he could tell, but you might be right. It's kind of hard to. I'm not sure.
I think if Sawyer Strohsnyder did tell and didn't lose his mind completely rounding first that his dad caught the ball, put this kid in the big leagues right now. He's got the gumption to handle it. He's got like, if he's not getting flustered by that, he could play in the playoffs right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I'm not sure. The story doesn't clarify whether he could tell it was him. He does have this great quote. He said, "My dad, he can't sit still, so he loves to run around the stadium. I'll just be looking up after a foul ball or something and see him on every different side of the stadium. I think it was just the right place at the right time." Oh, it's so good. Wow. All right. Anyway,
so
back to you.
Another reason to hope that Sawyer Strohsnyder is good, besides, of course, DC people know that Strohsnyder's Hardware Store is an area institution. I have a Strohsnyder's Hardware hat that I wear sometimes, and I am going to be calling Sawyer Strohsnyder the Hardware Store because he's got so many tools.
That's good. Not inaccurate. Like, I'm a big fan of this kid. I talked to him at the combine. Like, when he fell at 66, I was like, okay, sure, good for the Brewers.
Could he end up on the Nats and then really be the Hardware Store?
Tell Taboni, make it happen.
Let me call Paul. Better call Paul. My good this week is the MVP 2005 guy. This story is so freaking up our alley. It's crazy. Jay Lucarelli, making history from his mom's kitchen table in Jackson Township, Ohio. Jordan, you should drive out there. That's probably what, about 40 minutes from you?
Not far from me at all. I should go pay him a visit and say congrats.
Jay Lucarelli set out to throw a perfect game in MVP Baseball 2005 with Roy Oswalt. And after 1,993 attempts, he finally got it with a laser beam line drive right back up the box. Hashtag scary moment. Roy Oswalt, the virtual version, snagging this to finish the perfect game. This is heroic stuff. Unbelievable article from friend of the program, Stephen Nesbitt, over at The Athletic, who interviewed both Lucarelli and, of course, Roy Oswalt, who was on a bulldozer in central Mississippi when he found out about this challenge. Now, there's so much good stuff in here. There's Tumgus, really, too much good stuff. This means so much to me.
Yeah.
I loved these games. But not only did I love these games, and Jordan can vouch to this, my favorite baseball player, after Cal Ripken retired, until I stopped having favorite baseball players like a child, was Roy Oswalt. I had posters in my room. He was my password to like all my AIM accounts as a teenager. No player meant more to me than Roy Oswalt. And the reason he meant so much to me is because he was so nasty on MVP 2004. That was the game I fell in love with more than 05. I know 05 is better. 04 is backwards compatible on the Xbox 360. The hard ones, the hardos out there, you know what I'm talking about. The curveball, the Oswalt curveball. If you just spotted that low and in under the hands to a right-handed hitter, it was dynamite. Now, that's not a pitch anybody ever throws, like an inside and low curveball, same-sided. Like, it just doesn't exist. But in that game, it freaking worked. And to see this story get so much traction and to see it happen with Oswalt was meaningful to me. And so congratulations to Jay Lucarelli. Go read Stephen Nesbitt's story. There was a really great paragraph in here that sort of exemplified what I like about streaming culture. It's not really for me all the time, but it has the ability to take someone like Jay Lucarelli, who is an internet cultural, you know, an anonymous character, and turn them into someone real. This is from Nesbitt. To Lucarelli, becoming a main character on Baseball Internet overnight felt like a badly needed opportunity. It's been a hard year. Lucarelli moved back home for a fresh start this spring after bottoming out in Los Angeles, short on cash and stuck in a dead-end job. He's staying in his mother's basement. He spends most days filling out job applications online and waiting for calls that never come. Quote, but the second I turned on the stream, he said, it felt like putting on a new persona. I tuned in and people cared. That's what it's all about. Hell yeah. That is good.
That is good. That is good. When I saw that, I was like, wow, Royals Walk. Because part of the story is he's like, well, I'm not just going to do this with Randy Johnson. That's boring. Right? I'm just going to pick a great pitcher, but then not do...
Royals Walk was pretty freaking good, brother.
He was. You know, this is not just picking anybody. He wasn't doing it with our guy. whenever I think about playing 04.
Tim Spoonie Barger.
Nate Bump, but also Tim Spoonie Barger. Nate Bump. Always Nate Bump. Let's go to bad. My bad is sort of related to your bad, kind of. Jorge Polanco is going to have season-ending left ankle surgery. This really bums me out, I got to be honest. Jorge Polanco, who signed a 2-year, $40 million contract, effectively to replace Pete Alonso at first base. It was like, Jorge Polanco is going to play first base. He ended up playing 2 games at first base and then another 35 at DH for the Mets, dealing with a wrist injury, with ankle injuries, with all kinds of stuff. And he finishes with negative 1.4 WAR and a 21 OPS plus. This is someone who was coming off basically the best year of his career and an epic, amount of contributions to the Mariners in the postseason, including the walk-off to win the DS. And when he's going, a really, really fun hitter to watch. And just among the many Mets disasters this year, and the Mets are cooking. I told everyone the post-deadline Mets are going to keep winning, and they have continued to do so. But there is no way to spin this one. The reason why this is extra bad, Jorge Polanco, when the Mets were in Cleveland, when I saw them, and I was like, oh my God, they're about to go get hot. He snapped an 0-for-29 with a homer, and it was like, oh my God, signs of hope. Maybe Jorge Polanco can finish strong. And instead, he's just like in so much pain all the time, which was kind of the whole thing. And when they signed him, it was like, okay, he just had this awesome season. I made the point then, he has essentially never had 2 consecutive good, healthy seasons in his whole career. He has either been good and hurt or good and or bad and healthy. Yeah. He's never lined up. And now we have worst case scenario here. And he's owed $23 million next season. So I don't know, man. That ass is just on the list of Mets messes for the front office. This is way up there.
He is a good guy. And I'm going to tell a Jorge Polanco story that I have not told you that I think is going to make you laugh. So great. I'm up at Citi Field. This is a couple of weeks ago. I'm in the clubhouse. I think I was probably talking to a friend of the program, Anthony DiComo, about what he was like, hey, what do you got coming up the next couple of weeks? And I was like, oh, I'm here in the city doing this deadline show with Jordan. And then next week I'm going to the beach. Okay. Fast forward.
Yep.
Like an hour. I'm talking to Kai Correa, Mets bench coach. Polanco walks by us and he goes, walks up to me. And I've like talked to Polanco a couple different times. Like he's a very, very good dude.
Really nice guy.
And he points at me. He goes, hey man, I had a dream about you. I'm like, what? Kai and I are like, what? It's like, I had a dream about you. I had a dream that you and I together, we went to the beach. And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, next week I had a dream. Me and you going to the beach next week. And I go, wait, that's nuts, dude. I'm going to the beach next week. How did you know that? Look, I'm sure. And I pull my phone out. I go to the calendar and like on my calendar, I'm like just at beach. He's like, that's crazy. What are the odds? And he just starts walking away. And Kai and I are like dumbfounded. And then he just turns around and goes, I heard you talking about you're going to the beach. And that was it. That was the interaction. And later I found out from DiComo that after I said the beach, DiComo, like apparently I was surprised being too loud in the clubhouse. But Polanco said something to DiComo that was like, that guy says he's going to the beach. I'm going to go mess with him. And so like this was like a premeditated Jorge Polanco screwing with me in a very wholesome way. Isn't that a great little story?
It was
that
so
is
funny.
So good. Now, the version that, you know, it also makes me think of, and I think we've told this before, is the Ozzy Albies. The first time we met Ozzy. One of the weirdest interactions we've ever had was in AA Ozzy, whatever year, 2015, 16. First
Jackson.
Time we, in Jackson, Tennessee. And we're interviewing Ozzy Albies. And Ozzy, like, just, he was just like, I know to Jake. He was like, I know you from somewhere. It's like, we have never like, spoken. But he was
never
serious.
Met.
Like, that, this was not a bit. He just couldn't.
He was
get
not messing
over
with me. And the best part of that is like, Ozzy, like, I'm not from Curacao, bro. Like you don't
very much not
know me from there.
Oh my God. So funny. All right, that's an incredible story. That is so funny. And yeah, now I'm even more sad about Jorge Polanco. So I hope he somehow.
But here's the thing.
Part of me is like, oh, okay, he's doomed forever. He's come back from all these injuries so many times that like he might be okay next year. I don't know. Like, who knows?
Dude, absolutely. He could totally be a meaningful member of the 2027 Mets. From a potentially meaningful member of the 2027 Mets to a very meaningful member of the 2024 Mets. And earlier, Pete Alonso hit a home run that wasn't. He also hit a home run that was. The polar bear has been on fire recently for the Baltimore Orioles.
I almost picked him earlier.
Doing everything in his.
Oh my God, he's been so good.
He's been unbelievable. Doing everything in his power to keep the birds in the race. He goes yard against Will Warren on Wednesday night. I was at this game. 3-3 then later on, he lofts a high fly ball down the left field line off Brett Hedrick. Over the foul pole, ruled foul on the field, goes to replay, and the call stood. Here's why this is bad. It's not clear from the camera angles whether it's fair or foul. There are multiple angles that show multiple things. The ball goes over the pole, and when the ball goes over the pole, like, you really need a camera angle that is dead on the line to see whether it's fair or foul. What is bad is not even, like, there's so many layers to this, right? Should we have the technology that makes this possible? Absolutely we should. Could you just make the poles taller? Yeah.
Probably.
These are the original poles from Memorial Stadium, by the way. Like, wow. Hitters are hitting the ball higher and further than they used to. Maybe it's time for some taller poles, right? We can build taller poles. But at the very least, and the reason why this is bad, how do we not have a camera angle that's definitive? It's actually not that hard. You just have a set camera that goes straight down each foul line and just doesn't move. It's fixed. They have this with like the pylons in football. There are so many different solutions to this problem. I am going to just give you the simplest one, a better camera angle. Because what made this so controversial in the broadcast, there was one camera angle where it was like, that's definitely a homer. And there was one where it was like, that's definitely not a homer. Why don't we have fixed frickin' cameras? It makes no sense to me. So that, more than the call itself, is what is bad, is that this should not be something that is controversial. Once this happens in October, it will get sorted out, but it probably won't be until then.
This was bad. What was good is our pal Kevin Brown's entire call of the entire situation. His incredulity was outstanding. Yes. Most specifically, when Will Little reconfirmed that the call stood, when he said, you know, after replay review, the call stands. Kevin just going, "Come on, Will!" was so great. That just killed me. I already told him this. And Kevin, if you're listening, sorry, you have to hear it again. But it just made it sound like Will Little umpires every Orioles game. And like Kevin and Will Little just have this ongoing thing where he's just like,
they're getting into it all the time.
Will, come on, Will. Also, it wasn't Will's decision.
Come on, Will.
You know, I guess Will called individually. But the replay was not his decision. So anyway.
Let me do my Ugla. And then you'll go second because yours is better. From one Mets creature to another. That's it. If you're listening to this,
about.
you know what we're talking about. I really hope you've seen this. I don't know where this first came from. I don't know who actually filmed this video, but the video is a raccoon or another unidentified creature sticking its paw or hand or extremity up through a hole in the floor of the front row at Citi Field to snag some peanuts that have been left on the ground. I think this is out in the outfield, in the front row down the left field line. This is the most ugly thing for a variety of reasons. There are animals scurrying around fields and stadiums. This is a thing that happens. This is so freaky. It's so like horror film in a way that could only happen to the Mets and only happen to the Mets this season. And on top of that, what is one of the most iconic moments in Mets history of the last 5 years? The Jeff McNeil, Francisco Lindor, rat-raccoon fight, or cover-up of the rat-raccoon fight. Raccoon. Not rat.
Raccoon. Definitely not a rat. Yeah. Yeah. And if you're not familiar with that original tale, I mean, that was early 2021, which is a very strange time for a lot of reasons. Yeah. You can go Google that. But yeah, I mean, this is ugly. This is also bad, but definitely ugly as well.
I mean, what's the joke here? Like, oh, it's that's where they keep Jeff Wilpon. Oh, like, so that's where, you know, Jorge Blanco's been all year.
I mean, here's the thing. Like, it's just, it just looks more, because of the cinematic element of this video, it's more of like, if you put the right music over it, it would feel like a horror film more than like a ha-ha. Like, correct. It is kind of terrifying to watch, but also very funny. And most importantly, it's the Mets. However,
ugla.
Jake, my ugla is Hall of Fame level ugla. I mean, this is really what it's all about, I would say.
This is why we wake up in the morning.
This is why we do it, folks. On Thursday, the Reds had one of the worst losses of the season. And that was its own thing. However, what I didn't think I would be thinking after a game like that was, I wonder what Daniil Medvedev thinks about this one. I wonder how pissed off Daniil Medvedev, one of the best tennis players in the world, I wonder how he feels about Dane Meyers dropping the last out as the Reds try and cling to any semblance of a wild card hope. But that is exactly what I was thinking, because the former number one tennis player in the world is apparently a gigantic Reds fan. This is so funny. And so ugly and so wonderful. This is a Russian tennis player who is about our age. I think he's about a year younger. And he's very successful. However, this week, or last year, he played at the Cincinnati Open, a big-time tennis tournament, a tournament that he won several years ago. Last year, however, he was eliminated early. And so then he decided, I'm going to go to a Reds game. And he went to a Reds game. And he was like, oh my goodness, I have a great, this is fun. And also, he apparently, growing up in Russia, would play a baseball video game that has not really been clarified on his, what he described as PlayStation, maybe a PSP, which is a really forgotten about console, I should say. So I don't know what game he was playing. Perhaps it was some version of MVP baseball. I don't know. That he enjoyed. And so he sort of knew some things about baseball. And then he had this experience at a Reds game a year ago and decided, like, I am all in on the Reds. And if you don't believe him, if you think this is just some bit and where he's just like, oh, I went to a Reds game, I pretend to be a Reds fan. No. This guy has gotten all the way into it. And he gave this interview to the Tennis Channel, which he gets quizzed on the Reds, and he makes it
one clear of my favorite channels.
He's basically that he's watching the Reds all the time. He gets quizzed on all the Reds leaders. He tells exactly, almost gets Chase Burns' ERA to the decimal point. He's talking about Sal Stewart and Ellie De La Cruz. And it's just incredible to watch this Russian tennis player say, being quizzed about the Reds' best pitcher, and him saying something along the lines of, well, that one's the obvious. It's Chase Burns. In his thick Russian accent.
The best part is when he goes, it's like, who's leading the team in home runs? He goes, oh, Sal Stewart, 26.
26. Medvedev threw out the first pitch. A very, by the way, like, pretty good I thought for a guy who,
I mean, he's the sixth ranked tennis player in the world.
That's fine. I understand that. And I guess it's true. Tennis players probably have more upper body athleticism than some of the other athletes that really look bad. But he's still throw the first pitch on Monday. And, but now I'm just like, listen, the Reds last year, they made the postseason. I'm curious how he experienced that, their short-lived postseason experience last year. And now I hope that he keeps this up. And I hope that if the Reds, it's a tough time for them right now, but not a great time to be a Reds fan, but he's going for it.
Okay. So he talks about the moment where he realized he loved baseball. Like he went to this game last year and the Reds
lost in extras.
I went back and found this game.
Yes.
Okay, so it was August 16th of last year, a home game against the Brewers. He says it was pretty busy. 39,000 people attended this game, which was one of the biggest Reds crowds of the year. I can
check that, yeah. But I mean, Saturday against Milwaukee makes sense, yep.
Heartbreaker.
Yeah, tough one.
They are up 2-1, top nine. They allow a run to the Brewers in the top of the ninth on a Sal Frelick RBI ground out. Both teams score in the 10th, push it to the 11th. At the top of the 11th, Andrew Monasterio rips a three-run homer. In the bottom half, Noel V. Marte hits one to cut it to one. Matt McClain hits a deep fly ball to end it. And Daniil Medvedev weeping in the stands, a dream fallen just short.
That, you know what's so crazy? That was the Brewers, like, what was it, 14th straight win? 15th straight win? Like, he could have gone and been like, oh my God, the Brewers, this team's magical. Yeah. They can't do anything wrong, Andrew Monasterio. And instead, he's like, nah, give me the Reds.
Give me the Reds. This is like us picking the Sabres. Last thing, and then we will get out of here. So I went to the Reds schedule from last year and sorted by attendance to see if this was truly one of the biggest. And you know what happens when you go to the 2025 Reds and you sort by attendance? You see the dumb freaking NASCAR game at the top with 91,000 people. And I had a minor heart attack where I was like, how did they fit 91,000 people in a Great American Ballpark? Turns out they didn't. Jordan, we have a weekend of baseball ahead of us, as is always the case. Some good series this weekend. We got Cardinals, Phillies. We got Braves, Brewers. We got the Pirates heading out to LA to try and keep their season alive. We have Rafael Devers making his return to Fenway Park tonight. Giants, Red Sox. We got the Blue Jays in the Bronx. We got the Rays in Baltimore. This is a strong weekend. Cubs, Mariners. One thing I didn't like this past week that maybe you didn't realize is that there were very few late games. None of the West Coast teams, none of the Pacific like time zone teams were at home, which is very weird and very rare. So the latest game all week started at 8:40. I didn't really know what to do with myself out in Colorado. That won't be the case this weekend. Jordan, so good to have you back. I feel like I've been talking to myself for the last week and a half.
No. Hey, shouts out to Chelsea James. Shouts out to Katie Wu, Kevin Brown. Shouts out to Chelsea's adorable daughter. I don't know why she doesn't just co-host this podcast. But I'm happy to be back. Thank you for filling in while I was gone. Everyone, enjoy the baseball. Thank you to Carter Singh and Ross Tudor for producing. And we'll be back on Monday with more Baseball Barbercast. See ya.